Thursday, May 9th, 2018, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, who knew what when? We're hearing more and more about both Charlie Rose and Matt Lauer in the past few days. We've got an update on each of those cases. At a time when we know that the public's trust in the news media isn't exactly at its highest, CNN fights in court to keep its editorial processes secret. We'll talk about that move. And could NBC's corporate owner be getting between a Disney-Fox merger? There's a lot more that hopefully we're going to get to as well. But let's start with the report that was released just after the open of business this morning from NBC into Today Show host Matt Lauer's history of workplace harassment. According to memos that were obtained by the Washington Post, that investigation concluded that there was no evidence that senior executives at the network were aware of any complaints against Lauer until November of last year. The company said it reached that conclusion following interviews with 70 or so current and former employees. Andy Lack's message to employees wasn't exactly all roses and rainbows, though. He did acknowledge there have been some real problems there culturally in the past, even if those hadn't necessarily come to the light or the knowledge of managers until November.
Well, and I think the thing that he said that was the most telling to me was that, quote, employees at NBC News may have worked in an environment that they felt was not conducive to reporting allegations of harassment. So even if there wasn't any paperwork documenting that management knew, it was clear that folks didn't feel like they could report that. The other problem, of course, that we talked a little bit about last week is that this is an internal probe, as opposed to hiring an outside expert to come in and take a look. So there's always going to be skepticism about what they turned up, especially in light of all the context we discussed with Ronan Farrow and with the Access Hollywood tape and Tom Brokaw.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you, Mike. The problem I have with this is that it was an internal investigation, even though they did consult with two outside attorney legal firms. They still didn't do due diligence in actually bringing someone in to do it who was an independent investigator. And so they're going to be, you know, some calls for them to actually do that, because there is this sort of perception there that there is a culture that has been there for a long time. They acknowledge that there are problems, but they don't go, this report doesn't go to that extent. And I think that's where they're going to get some pushback, maybe from some employees on the inside who are saying, you know, you need to do more than just this.
Or former employees. I mean, I read this and I think about how it really throws Ann Curry under the bus after some of the things that she had said she experienced while she was there too.
Well, it's interesting because what Ann Curry said was that she told management that there was a Matt Lauer problem. But according to the investigation, she wouldn't say who she told that to, and she acknowledged that she didn't make reference to a specific person who was alleging that they had been harassed. Now, having it all been said, she also refused to basically cooperate with the investigators on the details, and you can understand why.
Yeah, well, and definitely you can understand why. I think a lot of that goes to the fact that the investigator wasn't independent. I think if the investigator had been independent, there may have been, you know, she may have decided that, hey, okay, you are really taking this seriously, and I will cooperate. But she has no need to do that at this point, especially if it's not going to be an independent investigation.
I thought it was interesting too. So the four women who came forward with the allegations that were investigated, they all four, apparently, if you believe the report, acknowledged that they didn't tell anybody in HR. They didn't tell upper management. But two of the four nonetheless said they were confident that management knew what was going on.
And this is where I have a problem. Okay, they didn't tell upper management, but they told someone, you know. And if they told someone, then maybe that person should have told management, because, I mean, they were confiding in someone within their within their sphere, or who may have had influence over them, to say, hey, this is a problem. I need you to really take this seriously. And that whole thing about what upper management didn't know, that just seems to be a cop-out to me.
Do you wonder, though, Amy, whether the whole thing with Tom Brokaw also just sort of went poof in this?
Well, yeah, that has gone poof in the night. I do want to comment, though, on what Ernest was saying. Yeah, they told someone. And I guess I say this as somebody who in the past has had people come to talk to me about those things. Yeah, there is that inclination that the person who has heard what happened to someone should go and then report it.
Right.
But I also can't get past the point that that takes away the accuser's agency to decide how they want to move forward with something. And is it necessarily my place to move something forward if perhaps an accuser just wants someone to know or wants someone to listen?
No, I mean, you make a very good point. And that does put someone in a precarious situation. But it also doesn't promote
change,
right,
when you adhere
exactly.
to that.
The downside to that is that begins to reinforce this culture. So if someone isn't talking about it, someone in authority who can actually do something about it, then that culture just becomes reinforced, and it can manifest itself in a bunch of different negative ways.
Yeah, it is. It is very complicated. I want to talk a little bit about the Charlie Rose case, too, because there have been some interesting developments there. Kyle Godfrey Ryan, one of the women accusing Charlie Rose of sexual misconduct, appeared on CNN's Reliable Sources on Sunday. She worked for him for about a year and a half on his PBS program. Here's what she had to say.
The beginning was beautiful and exciting. He's talented and amazing. But within a few months, the stories that I talked about at the Washington Post, this behavior of beratement and groping, continued until the day I left.
Did it, you feel, affect or hurt your career later? Did it change the way you viewed your role?
I did decide that I didn't want to work in journalism. Hmm. But in full transparency, I'm very happy with what I do today.
She is one of the co-founders of an organization called Press Forward, which is working to, according to its website, develop solutions that will change the media industry to make newsrooms safe, inclusive, and fair for all women. The appearance on CNN was her first on television, and that was her first interview there, but she was quoted in Page Six late last week saying that she thinks Charlie Rose might be trying to make a comeback. What exactly is her line of thinking in that? What's leading her to believe this could be going on?
There have been talk, rumors, leaks, whatever, that Charlie Rose is thinking about or pitching the idea for a show where he would talk to other men accused of sexual assault and sexual harassment, and to try to shed a light on why that happened and how people can improve. And so it's supposed to be, I guess, making lemons out of lemonade. And I'm kind of skeptical when I hear that.
Yeah, I have that. In this particular climate, I don't think that show is going to go very far at all. I mean, what I found interesting in some of the new allegations mm-hmm. that are coming out on Charlie Rose is this kind of behavior goes all the way back to 1970.
Yes. We're talking decades,
yeah,
with
decades.
An additional 27 women.
I mean, back when he was doing
forward.
Night Watch, which is a show that, you know, many people, you know, unless you're, you know, my age or Mike's age, wouldn't even know existed. And so There's a clear pattern here, and there are people who, at least according to the Washington Post reporting, mm-hmm. there are people at high levels of CBS News, high levels of NBC News, who knew that this was going on. So this even goes back to NBC during his days there. So, I mean, there's someone at some point you would think would have said something. And the other thing here is that the lawsuit that was filed by, I think it was six or seven women, it's the stories on our Links blog, he's not mentioned in that, but he was working there at the time that a lot of this is going on.
I understand what the person was saying about it's possible that he could be redeemed or be forgiven at some point, and everybody ought to have that opportunity. If he takes deliberate efforts over a significant period of time to show that he's changed and he wants to do something different, everybody should give him a chance to do that. But I think CBS...
Has there been enough time, though?
No.
Like 30-plus years of behavior. No. This hasn't even been 6 or 8 months.
No. But I also think that, you know, Ernest, just the larger point is that CBS is being accused of the same sort of cover-up that NBC does, and CBS is also, executives have claimed, we didn't know nothing until the very end.
Right.
And yet in another piece on our Links blog, Rhea Brava, who worked for Rose for a while, basically said everybody knew. I heard people and sales clerks gossiping about it on the Upper East Side. My professors in my graduate classes were talking about it as an open secret. Hard to believe that could be going on, and management in the network didn't
know. But you have that same narrative playing out with Matt Lauer. that same narrative is playing out with him that played out with Charlie Rose, and that's where I think I have a problem with these with the NBC investigation, because it doesn't really point to the fact that there are people there who knew, but just because the higher up executives didn't know means that, oh well, you know, we are a little bit absolved of this, but we understand we have a cultural problem, we're going to work on it. I have some serious issues with that.
Okay, I want to move on. Okay. The Denver Post, where it appears the effects of staffers' revolt against its hedge fund owner is really starting to ripple through the newsroom. Editorial page editor Chuck Plinkett resigned on Thursday after Alden Global's chief operating officer spiked another editorial. It was supposed to run this past Sunday and was going to make public that Alden had instructed the top editors at Digital First Media Publications not to mention the companies without top-level clearance. Plunkett began his editorial by saying that there was a serious threat to journalism in Colorado and across the country, and it's growing stronger. It ended with, "Journalism's mission is too important for such atrocious apostasy. We renew our call for Alden to reinvest in its newsrooms or release us to better ownership." That actually was something that he had in a Rolling Stone piece giving his first-person account. Among those who are speaking out and saying that Denver deserves better, the city's mayor, Michael Hancock, who admits the paper hasn't always been kind to him, but it has always been fair.
We can trust that what we read is has at least been vetted, and give at least those who are accused the opportunity, like myself, to, you know, give a response that is appropriate and accurate, and but at least have the balance. And you can't count on that within the social media platform. The Denver Post is a responsible, objective medium here in our city, and we've got to believe that it's important for democracy and for those of us who depend on getting good information in our city that it survives, and I believe that to my core.
So maybe it's me, but to hear a politician stand up for journalists, it was just kind of refreshing. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong here. He does have a position and a reason to want to stand up for
yeah,
him, too.
I mean, it is in today's environment, yeah. It is very unusual
you
to
don't
see
a mayor go up and do that.
Mayor get up and make that kind of statement. But I think what you're seeing in Denver and many other large metropolitan cities is they really feel as if, you know, the newspaper in those cities give them identity. And if that newspaper is threatened either with closure or with a diminished capacity to be able to cover those big issues, then the city loses something.
Well, and again, with the case of Denver, it lost a lot about a decade ago when the Rocky Mountain News went away. He even brought that up in that interview. Yeah.
He may very well believe every single word he said, and I give him credit for saying it publicly, but also it doesn't take a lot of courage for a politician to stand up and say, we need to have great journalism in our hometown, and these bad hedge fund folks from out of town are making it impossible for that to work. I think what really, and it's also great for other people to be standing up for journalists, mm-hmm. and for journalists to stand up for themselves,
right.
But what's going to matter in Denver and other places, are people going to step forward from the community with money, either people with big, deep pockets or some consortium of some kind, and back real journalism in those communities?
No, I think this is the argument that we brought up back when the story first broke about what the journalists there in Denver were doing. What bothers me about this is that, not so much bothers me, but you know, the editorial page editor, he knew that he was on thin ice. Mm-hmm. After what they did about a month ago, he knew he was on thin ice.
And he was shocked. He even says in the Rolling Stone thing, he was shocked he hadn't been fired right then and there.
So he knew he was lobbing another grenade. He knew that this was probably the last grenade he was going to go out with a bang. Because at some point, your employer is going to go like, wait a minute. You know, we gave you an opportunity to criticize us. Fine. But we're not going to just let you sit here and just lob grenades over the wall over and over and over again and not have some sort of reaction to that.
Well, let's be clear. They didn't fire him.
He walked out.
Now, they did everything they could to pressure him into leaving.
Right.
And so he should have expected that.
Yeah, what I was saying was that, you know, what they did was basically say, we're not going to allow you to print this in our paper,
mm-hmm.
you know. And if you want to do it, then, you know, you can resign and go do it somewhere else. But you're not going to be able to lob any more of these things against us in our own publication that we own. And to that extent, you have to, I mean, I think people really need to understand, including politicians, this is a business. They do own it and they can control it.
Okay, well, maybe things are starting to look a little better for those working in Tronc's Chicago newsroom, where the management of the Chicago Tribune voluntarily agreed to recognize the formation of a union there and begin the process of collective bargaining. I've been through management training at the old Tribune company. I can tell you right now, Colonel McCormick is spinning in his grave, one of the most anti-union companies ever. But now, in the last few months, we've seen it happen at the LA Times. We've seen it at the Chicago Tribune. We've seen these unions form and win. Give an outsider's view to this, because I personally am so close not only to that place, but even in a lot of ways to a lot of the people who are on the organizing committee. So for me, this is still very personal. I want to hear an outsider's take on it.
I mean, they're trying to spin what was going to be bad news. Already they knew at the Los Angeles Times that overwhelmingly the vote was for a union. Same kind of situation there. In Chicago, although no vote had been taken, I believe that there had been an expression of support for the union.
85% of the newsroom that was eligible signed signature cards.
So it was going to happen, right? So they might as well get out in front of it and try to make it seem like that they were agreeing to work with the union.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Having started in newspapers back when the Gill and various corporations, including the old Capital Cities, which is now McClatchy, you know, there was union busting. I mean, we thought I was trained in it as part of that management training
when I was back at CLTV News.
I mean, we thought that that was the end of unions. But what you're seeing now is that many of these journalists are basically saying, look, this is our last opportunity, our last chance to have some sort of voice in the direction of where journalism labor is going to be in this new paradigm. And this might be the only way that we can do it, because everything else we've tried hasn't worked.
It's interesting for me, just kind of looking back on it, one of Colonel McCormick's, you know, theories and how he carried out his business was that if you paid people well enough and you treated them right, they would never feel the need to unionize. Now that we've seen it at two of the papers, you have to wonder if it's coming next in Orlando or in Fort Lauderdale or in Allentown, the Baltimore Sun having been a Guild paper long before it was even part of the Tribune family.
I mean, you can make an argument, and I tend to believe that newsrooms are not the perfect solution to the problems that you have, because they can stifle innovation. Mm-hmm. They can make it difficult for you to deal with employees who are not doing their job. But in this climate, I don't know that that argument really holds much weight, because there's such peril for employees in newsrooms that if the union is the only option to prevent them from mass layoffs, that's what you're going to go with.
And that, I think that's basically what I mean by where we are right now. I mean, it's the layoffs that they're trying to do something about.
Okay. I want you to picture this one for a second. Mickey Mouse makes a run for 21st Century Fox, and it looks like it could be a done deal until at the very last minute, it appears that Universal could sweep in and buy it for cash. Okay, so that's kind of dramatic. But what it really looks like here is that Comcast is coming in and could be coming in with a hostile takeover with a cash bid for 21st Century Fox and kind of outbidding Disney.
Well, they're in the same kind of situation that Disney is in. I mean, they've got Netflix and Amazon and all these other players trying to take away their business, hiring the best producers, putting out programs, going for audience. They need something, so they might as well try to get some crown jewels in the same way Disney is. The one thing they've got going for them, theoretically, is that they can make a cash offer, although apparently Rupert Murdoch wasn't really thrilled to have
cash. He doesn't like that idea because there's like tax issues associated with it.
It sounds like to me is that, you know, the reason they're doing this is to sort of try to throw a wrench into this, because they don't want Disney to have that as well. So, you know, we'll go after it. We really don't want it, but we'll go after it anyway to keep them from having it. I mean, it's basically, you got some big bullies out there that are calling each other's bluffs.
And you've got this whole domino theory in here. They said that they would only make this cash offer contingent
upon the
AT&T Time Warner merger going through.
And that's, we don't know where that is right now. I mean, it's, you know, one day you'll hear that, you know, okay, they're going to approve it. And then the next thing you know, that may not happen. So, I mean, I thought the deal would be really close to being done right now. But, you know, who knows what's going to happen there.
Okay, well, we'll keep watching that one. At a time where trust in the news media is at its lowest, and as a result, we're seeing news organizations go out of their way to be transparent about their processes and procedures, We see it every day. The New York Times and the Washington Post publish their editorial policies on their websites. Here in Columbia, the Missourian opens up story meetings to the public. KUMU used to even have a segment called Your View, in which it answered viewers' questions about how decisions were made by the news staff. Then there's CNN, which appears to be going out of its way to keep its processes secret and asking a judge to let it stay that way. This all goes back to a single case in Florida that right now is making its way through the courts.
There's a doctor who's filed a defamation suit against CNN because of stories they did claiming that procedures he conducted at a hospital in Florida were resulting in child mortality at something like, was it three times the national average? So he's suing. And the CNN response, which is to say, we're not going to show you our practices manual, is kind of standard play for TV networks. I mean, they don't want those attorneys to come in for the plaintiffs and say, look, your stories didn't follow your own practices. So, I mean, this is pretty standard lawyering up, but it does fly in the face of, as you mentioned, some efforts to be more transparent.
Yeah, I mean, and this is where I think news organizations need to be more definitive and what they consider to be transparent. They throw the word transparency around. We want to be transparent. We want to be, well, okay, what does that actually mean? Are you talking about being transparent in your sources, being transparent in the direction in which your story, your overall story is going to go? Or do you mean transparency as in this case with how you actually go through the process? And I think that's where the question for this comes into play.
So, Mike, you're saying that this is something that is somewhat standard in television. Are you saying that maybe it's a cultural difference between what we're seeing maybe in print publications or some of the other areas?
I don't know.
Is it a TV print culture issue?
All the TV networks have the same practice when they're sued. They do not reveal these documents. Just because BuzzFeed or the New York Times or a few other folks are releasing these documents doesn't mean that that's the industry standard. I don't know what the industry standard is on
that.
Well,
I don't think there is an industry standard. I think it's dependent upon each and every organization to determine for themselves and for the audiences they're trying to reach how they want to pull their news together. The New York Times has this procedure that may not necessarily be the same thing that the Washington Post has, or NBC News or CBS. And so, you know, some may decide, hey, yeah, we want to release that, but others are like, no, we're not going to do that because we don't want to give away what we consider to be, you know, our edge over someone else.
Even if it is legally defensible, the problem you have now, especially for CNN, is that already they are one of the leading punching bags for the administration and critics of media credibility. And so it looks very hypocritical for them to say, we ask for documents, we expect transparency of the people we're covering, but no, we're not going to exhibit that same transparency.
And I think that's kind of the part that sat a little weird with me. The cold open from Saturday Night Live the other night, it probably was one of the best they've had in a long time. And at the heart of it, how the president pretty much did know that there was a payoff to Stormy Daniels. You know who didn't know about it, though? Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And once again, she found herself blindsided by the president and his knowledge when she was asked specifically about that by reporters, again, relying on that old line of, I gave you the best information I had at the time. How long does that line keep working?
Well, I think she's going to have to play that line until it doesn't work anymore. And it's not working, really. Okay. But she's going to have to continue to play that line because she's not privy to some of this information. I mean, you know, I'm pretty sure according to news sources, she didn't know anything about it until Rudy Giuliani said it on Fox. You know, so, you know, she's sitting there going like, oh, that's something else I got to deal with tomorrow because I was left out of the room. And then she has to go and talk to the Washington Press Corps. But then again, this isn't anything new for her.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, I think it's probably true she did not know. And to a certain extent, probably the White House Press Corps is sympathetic toward her because she didn't know. On the other hand, she continues to come out there and say things that we all know are not truthful. So it's hard to give her credit for that when the behavior is so consistent.
I mean, but, you know, you're being the White House, you know, you're in charge of communication for the White House. You're the White House spokesperson. And you know, your credibility is tied to the president. And if his credibility in certain circles is down, then that's where you're going to be. And that makes her job difficult.
Which took another real big hit last night around dinner time when it really became well known that there might be what could be construed as a pay-to-play situation. You were talking about the AT&T Times Warner merger that we're now finding out and hearing that AT&T was also making payments to Michael Cohen and to his LLC to get access and understanding of the administration, and then to get sued by the Justice Department.
But I mean, the only thing that Sarah Huckabee Sanders could do, if you believe she's trying to be a truthful mouthpiece for the White House, she has to get the president to agree to inform her and to not lie all the time. And nobody has succeeded in doing
that. Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're finding out certain pieces of information either on Fox and Friends or through Twitter, you know, and you work right down the hall from the guy that's actually putting information out, that's a problem.
Okay, so as we talk about the facts and the truth and the lies that are out there, it makes the timing of the launch of PolitiFact's new Sunday morning talk show pretty good.
Welcome to What the Fact, a show built upon the idea that cheesy jokes, low-budget props, and fact-checking go together like Donald Trump and a Make America Great Again hat. Aaron, are you ready?
So, Aaron, that's Aaron Sharkman, who is a former RJI fellow and an editor at PolitiFact. It's a low-budget show. It looks a lot like Wayne's World, but it looks like
it's going to be a lot of views of the news.
Travis McMillan is in my ear going, hey now, but it looks like it could be a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, and Aaron Schrockman has tried to do a lot of things as the executive editor of PolitiFact to try to reach beyond the choir, right? He's gone out and done town hall meetings in red states. He's hired congressmen to fact-check the fact-checkers. He did social media pieces with some of our students to try to reach people. So this is an extension of that. But he looks a little uncomfortable there on the set with the newsy person with, you know, all the flying graphics and the big red button.
I love the big red button. And I love the house on fire meter that's going off. That's great.
The pants on fire. This is going to be on Newsy. We've talked about that in the past. Newsy being a Scripps-owned over-the-top news delivery service, one that we here at the Journalism School have had a connection with since its inception. And a lot of our former students work there. The reach isn't so good, though. What do we have to do to get this show seen by people?
Well, basically, it's only available in a few markets at the moment, and you have to pay for it. And if you don't subscribe to either their cable channel, which I think is only available in like an Ohio and a couple of other places.
It is now. I did notice it's on Mediacom, but it is on one of the high tiers
but
in my
guide to
get
for it.
Yeah, it's well above the cable subscription.
And are you going to pay an extra premium? It's kind of like, you know, Al Jazeera America. We had that conversation a couple of years ago. You had to fork out like $5 a month extra for that one channel. I don't know what the deal is exactly for PolitiFact's WTF, but it probably is something that's going to take a while to build an audience. Yeah.
Okay, well, I know that I'm going to want to try to get eyes on it at some point. That music means we are out of time on our not-so-low-budget program here this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and making some jokes in my ear, and to Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.